everyone, and welcome back to another episode of BioBytes. I'm your host, Sophia Deng. And today, we're joined by Stuart Feierstein, a professor of biological sciences at Columbia University. Professor Feierstein is the former chair of Columbia University's Department of Biological Sciences, where his laboratory studies the vertebrate olfactory system. He's a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, and serves as an advisor for the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Program for the Public Understanding of Science. Professor Feierstein, thank you for being here today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah. So let's begin with your career. I know there are a lot of stories to tell, but I want to start from the beginning with how you became interested in biological sciences.
Well, it is a tricky story because I'm something of a late bloomer. I didn't go to college right out of high school, like most of you and your listeners probably did. I worked in the professional theater for some years, but I'd always had an interest in animal behavior. And at some point I was in the Bay Area in San Francisco, where I had gone to live and work in the theater for some time. And I had an opportunity to, I kind of got involved with a show that was doing well. And so I had my days free and I thought, well, I'll go take a course in animal behavior at the local university, which was San Francisco State University. I did that. It was a wonderful class. I really enjoyed it. I met an interesting professor there who ran the class and also had some very interesting research going on. So I took another class from him and joined his research team. And he sort of suggested to me at some point, why don't you just get a degree in biology and see what happens, you know? And so I thought, okay, he was a wonderful mentor. His name was Hal Markowitz. He passed away a few years ago. But he makes me realize how important mentorship can be, how influential a single person can turn out to be in your life, because it was him who really suggested I go ahead and get a degree in biology. And from there on in, I did that. I continued to work in the theater. And then when I finished it, I applied for graduate school. It was a little bit odd. I was then 35 years old and applying for graduate school, which in the 1980s was not so common. But I applied. I got turned down most places, but I got accepted at Berkeley, which is a very nice place. So I said yes. I'm fond of saying I think I got accepted there as the result of a clerical error of some sort. But nonetheless, I said yes. And I had another great mentor at Berkeley named Frank Werblin, who I'm still very close with, and finished my graduate degree there and then went on to do a postdoc with yet another great mentor, Gordon Shepherd, who I also remained close with until he unfortunately passed away last summer, but at a ripe old age. So that's how I got into biology. I slipped into it, but I was smart enough to stay in it.
Yeah, that was like a quite a big leap of faith.
I guess it was. I didn't feel that way at the time. Yeah. And, you know, we all live twice as long, or most of us, many of us can live twice as long as people used to. So it seems to me you might as well have a couple of careers if you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If the opportunity presents itself, it's often worth taking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your interest started with like animal behaviors.
Yes.
And now your laboratory studies like cellular mechanisms of signal transduction and olfaction. So could you tell us a bit more about how you transitioned into that interest?
Yeah, it's clearer in my mind than it may seem. Mm-hmm. I started graduate school in neuroscience at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. This was in the mid-1980s, and it was really just at the beginning of what was then the molecular and cellular revolution in biology in general, but in particular in neuroscience, where the study of molecules and cells was possible for the first time. Single neurons could be recorded from, and all of these sorts of things. And it seemed quite exciting, so I thought it was a boat that I shouldn't miss. And so I looked around for a way to combine that with animal behavior, and I thought, well, you know, most animals, a lot of their behavior is not dictated by, but is influenced by their olfactory sense. For many animals, it's very important. It's actually very important for us, too. We just don't realize it as much. Mm-hmm. But for many animals, of course, it governs mating and feeding and all sorts of social interactions and things like that. And so I thought, well, olfaction is close to animal behavior. What do we know about the molecular and cellular aspects of olfaction? And it turned out we knew very little. There just hadn't been much work done on it yet. And so I saw a lot of opportunity there. And so that's why I got into olfaction, thinking I'll go back to animal behavior one day. Uh-huh. And I do a little bit, to tell you the truth. I never really went back deeply into animal behavior, mm-hmm. but I still feel that olfaction is important in influencing behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And maybe could you like tell our audience a little bit about like your research and maybe explain like what you have discovered so far?
Sure, that's a big question. Like, you understand. I've unfortunately been at this for like 25 years, so half of what I've done I've forgotten already, I think. So it'll take a while to. I'll give you sort of the brief story. I mean, the brief story is that we're interested in. My lab has mostly studied the peripheral olfactory system, that is, the tissue that's in your nose that actually detects odors. So it would be like if I were working in vision, it would be like studying the retina. Or if it was hearing, I would be studying the ear. So not so much the higher centers, like, you know, the brain and so forth and so on, where the information gets processed, although we're interested in that. But my feeling is, unless you know what the peripheral receptors, what the receptors themselves out here in the world are telling the brain, then you really can't imagine how the brain is processing that. I think it's important to recognize that almost everything we know about the world comes to us through these little holes in our head, you know, and the skin over our body. And our brain just sits inside there getting messages in. It doesn't have any direct access to the outside world. And so I think it's important to try and understand what that message is. And so that's really what we've been concentrating on in the lab, is understanding how olfactory neurons in your nose respond to odors and what kind of a signal they send to the brain when they detect an odor.
Could you like maybe explain more about like the signal transduction pathway? Maybe give an example?
Sure. So one of the things that was discovered in olfactory neurons when people began applying molecular and cellular techniques, so my lab, but many others as well, both in molecular biology and in physiology and in biochemistry, began to realize that these olfactory neurons that are in your nose utilize a second messenger system, we call it, a transduction system. So let me go back just a half a step. Of course, the critical thing for any sensory system is to take a physical stimulus, whether it's electromagnetic waves or mechanical energy like hearing, or in the case of olfaction, chemical energy, chemicals. And somehow or another, we have to take that information in the outside world and turn that into something relevant to your brain. And that's a process we call transduction. Because you don't actually, photons don't actually go through your eyes and into your brain, and chemicals don't get into your nose and then go into your brain. They interact with specialized receptors in the retina or the olfactory system, in the olfactory tissue, or in your ear. And then they have to be turned into a voltage signal that can go to the brain and the brain can interpret. And in olfaction, that happens using this somewhat complex system, so I won't go into all the details of it. You can look it up if you'd like. It's easy enough. But it uses a couple of different chemicals that serve to amplify the signal. So one of the things we discovered many years ago in a collaboration with a laboratory in Italy, a woman named Anna Manini, who runs a laboratory, an olfactory laboratory in Italy, was that actually olfactory neurons can respond to a single odorant, just a single odor molecule. They can give you a very, very tiny electrical response. It wouldn't be enough for your brain to notice. Mm-hmm. You'd have to get a bunch of them responding together. But we learned that you can, that at the very limit, a cell can respond to a single molecule. Mm-hmm. Which is true, by the way, of vision as well, where photoreceptors can respond to a single photon. Mm-hmm. You can't see a single photon. It doesn't register in your brain, but your visual system does. Mm-hmm. And that happens by this amplification mechanism inside the cell, where binding a single molecule starts a cascade of enzymatic events that eventually open an ion channel, change the voltage of the cell, but there's a lot of amplification along the way. I'm sorry. Turned that off. Okay.
All right. It's okay.
Cool. The phone is off.
Oh, yeah. It's all good. Yeah, that sounds awesome. And that kind of relates to, so the next question would be, because you've been working on this research for decades, and also just in terms of researching the mechanisms, now we're seeing some recent advancements in AI and machine learning, and I believe in some of your paper you mentioned adopting medical chemistry concept to explore for example, a key feature of odorant antagonists. So could you explain how some of these advancements could be integrated into lab research?
Sure. So one of the things we've learned is that most olfactory stimuli, most of the natural things that we smell in the world, whether it's strawberries or flowers, roses or coffee or anything like that, are actually made up of a very complex blend of many chemicals, mm-hmm. which have odors. Coffee has 780 chemicals in it, all of which have some small bit of odor that add up to the odor of coffee. What's interesting to us is how the brain takes 780 separate stimuli and nonetheless creates a singular perception like coffee in mm-hmm. your brain. Same thing with a rose. If I put a rose under your nose, you would immediately say, oh, that's a rose. Mm-hmm. But in point of fact, that odor is a blend of about 200 different chemicals that interact with each other in all kinds of ways at the receptor level. And so that's what we're working on now, is trying to understand all of those interactions, mm-hmm. some of which are, as you mentioned, antagonistic or inhibitory. So any given molecule in a blend can activate some receptors, mm-hmm. but will also inhibit some other receptors. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it very complex kind of code that we don't really, we're really at the very beginning of that. So we don't have any idea how the brain decodes such a complex input. Mm-hmm. But that's what we're working on. And one of the hopes is that AI can begin to help us understand how this might happen. It might not. It might be that AI will be just as good at doing this as mm-hmm. our brains are, but uses a completely different mechanism, in which case it won't tell us anything about biology, mm-hmm. but it will tell us about a way to code odors. I think that's always the issue with AI, mm-hmm. not to get off on a tangent because I'm not an AI expert, but AI typically comes up with solutions. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say typically. AI comes up with solutions, and some of those solutions are similar to the ones that a human being or an animal would come up with, mm-hmm. but some of them are not. Some of them are totally computational solutions that would not be something that a brain or a living tissue would come up with. And so sometimes it explains things and sometimes it doesn't.
That definitely sounds like an exciting field. Hopefully one day it'll help.
Yeah, it'll be a great tool, I think. If we learn how to ask the right questions, it'll be a great tool.
Yeah, for sure. So at this current stage, then studying all these complex mechanisms, what does your, I guess, work in the lab look like from a day to day? What are some of the methods that your team approach to advance your research?
Well, we recently teamed up with a laboratory at the Zuckerman Institute here, laboratory of Elizabeth Hillman, who's a biophysicist and a neurobiologist herself. And she, among the many things that her laboratory is quite good at, is that she develops optical instruments, microscopes of various sorts. So one of the real leading technological parts of neuroscience, of biology in general, I would say, is in microscopy, which is interesting because biology really began with microscopy in a way, the ability to look at cells and small, bacteria and things like that, and the single-celled organisms with original microscopes. But now microscopy has become a very technological field, and Elizabeth Hillman is one of the leaders in that field, and she developed a technology called SCAPE, which stands for, if I get this right, swept confocally aligned planar excitation, I think. It's a long way to go for an acronym. But anyway, the SCAPE microscope allows us to visualize a piece of tissue from a mouse. We use mice typically in our research. But so we can take a piece of olfactory tissue from a mouse nose and lay it out on this microscope, and we can visualize many, many thousands of cells all at once. And so we puff an odor onto this tissue, and by some genetic tricks, if the cell is active, it glows green, it becomes fluorescent. And so And so we use that as a proxy, if you will, for activation. And so we can puff an odor on to this tissue and see that many cells light up because they've been activated by this odor. And then we can puff another odor on and see many cells light up. And then we can puff a blend of odors on and see that some cells now light up because they're sensitive to both odors, or some cells no longer light up, are active, because one of the odors has become inhibitory. And so now we have the opportunity to visualize thousands of cells at the same instant, but also this microscope, when you go back, gives you single cell resolution. So once you go back, once you do the experiment, you go back to the files, to the data, and you can pull out what single cells of interest are doing. So we get both a population view and the single cell view, which is, in my opinion, absolutely remarkable. I have to say, my thesis, which was completed in 1987, my PhD thesis, which took me about 5 years to do, 5 years of hard work like a thesis does, could now be done in probably an afternoon. So, which I'm thrilled with. I think that's great. You know?
Oh, technologies have progressed.
Yes, just to give you an idea of scale.
Yeah, that's truly exciting. Yeah. I'm sure it'll be more amazing work down the road.
So. I think so. I see no end to this, and that's the great thing.
Awesome.
You know, scientific progress, I think one of the things about it is that it's a positive feedback cycle. I think people don't realize that. Not all progress is. Sometimes progress is just linear in some areas, or maybe it's exponential, I don't know, occasionally. But in science, it's what I call a positive feedback cycle. It's actually kind of explosive, because the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know. So everything we learn in the lab, every result we get in the lab, almost invariably gives us 10 brand new questions that we hadn't even thought about before. And each one of those questions, if we get an answer to them, gives us 10 more new questions. And so it's like a positive feedback cycle. The more you know, the more you don't know, which gets you to know more. And so I see progress in science as this kind of virtually unending process that just continues to accelerate and can continue to accelerate without end, really.
Yeah, right. So I know you published a book about like ignorance, and
yes,
I was gonna like switch.
One of my
here.
Favorite subjects. We can get to that later.
Yeah.
That's all right. We can come back to that, or go to it now, whatever you like.
Or I was just gonna like maybe we can switch gear into like maybe start with like how you've been like pretty active in like public engagement with science. Like, could you tell us like how did you first get interested in the space?
Yeah. So I mean, I've always been a bit interested in it, at least partly, I think, because I came to science late in my life compared to most people. I mean, I was not an undergraduate. I didn't do undergraduate work. I worked in the theater, as we said earlier. And so when I finally began taking science classes, I think I was 30 years old, and I'd already been working in another field. And I think I had a certain empathy for the adult non-scientist, right? The person who'd never had any science, and how immense a thing it was, and how, you know, how much work it took to understand it in some ways. And so I've always had an empathy for the general public, because I just feel that science that's not shared widely is useless science. I mean, if it's locked up in the laboratory, or it's only available to an elite group of people who have studied for years and years and years, then it doesn't have an effect on society that it ought to have, I mean, our societies are very technologically and science-based these days. We depend on, I mean, we're recording on technology now. We're using cell phones. I mean, everything we do touches technology, and it touches science. You know, our cell phones work because of quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't understand quantum mechanics. I'm not a physicist. I could never hope to understand it. But I can use that cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to get at least a flavor of it. So it's always been a bit important to me. It became particularly important, I think, in my sort of dual role here at Columbia, where I'm both a professor, so I teach a class. I teach a class in neuroscience, cell and molecular neuroscience, no less. And it's, you know, it's very challenging class. It's 25 lectures, and I have to do a lot of work organizing it. It's a big fat textbook and all the rest of that. It's terrible for the students, I'm sure, in many ways. But it's challenging, and it's interesting to do, I admit. But I also work in the laboratory, where I work with graduate students and postdocs, and we work together every day, and we talk about all the things we don't know. I mean, nobody cares in a laboratory what you know. They only care about what you don't know and what you're after, the question you're trying to answer. And so that's what we talk about. We talk about the things we still don't know, the mysteries, what we can solve, what we can experiment on. And that's not only challenging and interesting, it's really, I have to say, exhilarating. I can't imagine a better life. And so I came to realize, though, this difference between the way we pursue science and the way it's perceived by the general public, by people taking science courses, you know, who think it's just a big pile of facts, it's a textbook. Whereas the facts mean almost nothing to us in the laboratory. Of course they're important. I mean, I don't mean to dismiss facts, but they're only useful because they lead to better questions. The whole purpose of getting a piece of data or a fact in the laboratory is so you can ask a better, a more sophisticated, a more interesting question. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we teach. And so that's when I began to think, well, we really need to change the way we present science, because it's really exciting in the laboratory and it's not very exciting in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Just first starting with like the scientific view, like how well do you think like the field, current field is doing on like asking more questions and asking like better questions?
The field of neuroscience, you mean, or biology, or science in general? Oh, no, I think science in general is great at that. I mean, if you're in a laboratory, if you're a working scientist, it's a great life. I mean, you spend all your time shrouded in mystery and unknowns and, you know, things like that that are really intriguing puzzles. So that's what we do for a living, you know. We solve really hard puzzles. Yeah. And everybody knows how much fun it is to solve a puzzle, especially if you get a solution. That's even better. But when we get a solution, it just opens up a new puzzle. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, it's like game playing. Mm-hmm. You know, you on level one and you figure out what you have to do to get to level two. But all of that stuff you collect up in level one, the weapons or the magic potions or whatever it is you need to get to level two, only gets you to a whole new set of challenges on level two, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on, all the way through a game. So it's like we're playing a game in the real world, mm-hmm. in a science laboratory. Mm-hmm. So I see this in every field of science. I don't think this is just biology or neurobiology. Mm-hmm. Every one of them is, you know, we're just always at the frontier.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just like going back to your point about education, because I'm personally also a biology student. So I know like the amount of basis knowledge you have to get through before going to that like exciting field. I don't know if you have any advice or just like, because it does require a lot of drive to get there first.
Yes. So it's a difficult question, because of course we can't dismiss the fact that a certain level of knowledge is critical to be able to ask a question. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't figure out what question to ask, how to ask a good question, unless you know something to begin with. Mm-hmm. But I do think we could get to the questions sooner in our biology classes. I mean, I wish that we taught biology classes in a way that said, all right, look, you can look this stuff up on Wikipedia, you can look this stuff up in the textbook, here it is, here are the facts, here are the few things you got to kind of know or feel, you know, intuitively comfortable with. And then let's talk about the questions. Then let's just go to the questions. And then if you ask a question, you say, well, and I say to you, well, look, a big question in neuroscience or a big question in olfaction is currently blah, 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 whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then you can say, well, I don't understand how you could get to that question. What's the basis for that question? Then I can go back and explain to you some of the boring facts, if you will. Whereas if I start with the boring facts, you have no idea why you're getting those, you know? We teach two semesters of neuroscience here at Columbia. The first semester is cell and molecular neurobiology, and the second semester is development and systems neurobiology, more about the brain, you know, and how it develops and how various brain systems work and so forth and so on. And I've always felt we teach them in the wrong order. We teach the basic stuff first and then the big stuff. But everybody I know, every student I know, including myself when I was a student, got into neurobiology because they want to know about the brain. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody wants to know about, the brain. But once you get into a course where you study the brain, you realize, well, okay, but in order to know about the brain, I can't really pose a sensible question about such a big thing as the brain. I better learn some of the other things that mm-hmm. you need to make a good question. Yeah. Then you're motivated to learn those things. There's mm-hmm. not drudgery, I hope. Mm-hmm. It's motivation. So that's the way I think we should do it, but yeah. I'm so far a lone voice.
We're working on it. Well, going back to your personal like education, because you started like later stage and you had to post through like degrees all the way to PhD. Do you find when you were doing it, do you find sometimes like it's hard to get through the basic materials, or did you feel you were motivated?
Well, yeah, that's a hard question. For one, it happened a long time ago, so I don't remember. You know, when you look back on things, they always look pretty easy. They look like it was a nice time, all the rest of that, because you don't remember, you know. I mean, I look back to when I was 16, I think, yeah, that was a great time. I forgot about all the pimples and all that stuff, you know. You don't see that. So my recollection of being an undergraduate was that I was having the time of my life. I mean, I thought, wow, you know, for the first time, because I didn't go to college originally, I'd go to these classrooms and some guy would stand up there, or a woman would stand up there and tell me everything they knew about something. And I got to listen to it and I thought, well, this is cool. What a great idea. You know, who thought of this? I think it was Aristotle, actually, probably, but I was just catching up with it. So I saw it as a treat. And I enjoyed being with fellow students who were, in most cases, 10 years younger than me, but were willing to hang out with me. And I still love that about science. You know, I'm now in my early 70s and I hang out in a laboratory full of students who are in their 20s and 30s. And I teach students in their early 20s and they're willing to put up with me, at least for the time being. So, and that's a great treat, of course, you know. So I've never looked back and said, oh, I regret having done this. This was too hard. I should never have done this. I've just, you know, I know a lot of people in science, young people in science, that worry about their careers. Is there a career for me in science? Is there any place for me? It seems like jobs are scarce and money is scarce. I have to say, I don't ever remember a time when jobs were like, oh God, just come on over. We need more people. And money here, we'll just dump money at you. Here you are. Just whatever you need. I mean, it's always been that case. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it's, maybe it's a little worse now or something, but my feeling is that we need more people doing science than ever before. There's more opportunities to do good science than ever before. There's more resources than ever before, and you can do it. It's not for everybody, but I think you can do it, yeah.
Yeah. In terms of education system, I mean, thinking back to when you like went through it and now you're still in the education field, like, how have you seen like the field like evolve over time?
Well, I wish I could say it has evolved more than it has. I wouldn't say it's evolved very much at all. I mean, I sat in classrooms, I had textbooks, I got lectures, I did midterms and finals, and I'm doing the same thing now to other poor students, you know. And I feel a little terrible about it. I would like to see that change. I think it's interesting to think about why it hasn't changed. So it's not that we don't know what would be better. I think we know better ideas about education. We've known them since John Dewey, who was a famous philosopher in the late 1800s, early 1900s. A famous philosopher, and in particular was interested in science and education. He was a member of what's called the pragmatists. Mm-hmm. In fact, he founded the field, one of the founders of the field, and importantly was the first, I believe, the first president of Teachers College here at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And he wrote widely on education and its importance to democracy, its importance to science, and all the rest of that. And Dewey laid out a whole series of interesting ideas about education and a better way to do it. So, and people have built on that in the literature, in the education literature. So I think we know the better way to do it. I could go through that with you, but I won't bore you or your audience with it right now. One could look all this up. The problem, I think, that's important to think is, what's the obstacle? If we know what would be better, why aren't we doing what would be better? Why are we sticking with the same old way? I mean, in the interim, since Dewey, we have an internet, you know, we have cell phones, we have calculators, we have computers. I mean, none of these things were around in Dewey's day and he saw a better way. Now, have any of those things changed our way of educating people? Not really, right? I mean, so now you use a computer and Wikipedia instead of a textbook, but that's not a real fundamental structural change, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, what are the obstacles? What is it that gets in the way of making those changes? Mm-hmm. And I would say, happily, in a way, that the things that get in the way are things that can be solved, both scientifically and to some extent philosophically. Mm-hmm. I think the things that get in the way are primarily evaluation and assessment. We do need a way to evaluate whether what we're doing is getting anywhere, whether people are learning something, whether people are becoming better at what it is we want them to become better at, and a way of assessing our progress. Mm-hmm. And we currently continue to work with very old tools like multiple choice exams and SATs and crap like that, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we have to figure out how to get rid of those things, mm-hmm. and how to reassess and reevaluate in different ways, mm-hmm. in ways that are more amenable to the way we want to teach. Because right now, our assessments and our evaluation methods, these standardized tests, are driving the curriculum and the way we teach. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that 90% of the students in my class are pre-med, and so I'm teaching in order for them to do well in the MCAT. But why should the MCAT determine the way I teach? I mean, that's ridiculous, right? That's bass-ackwards, as we said. So I think those are the problems. And I think there are many ways to solve these problems, and we need people from all areas, educators, professional educators, scientists, the statisticians, computer scientists, gamers, all these people to get together and figure out how we could reorganize our education around new evaluation techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I came across a class, I don't know if you're still teaching on like how ignorance mm-hmm. drives science.
Yeah.
And I think I saw something like pretty interesting set up. I'll do it if you can.
Well, that class came out of what I was talking about before, this discrepancy mm-hmm. between my life at the laboratory and my responsibilities in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Where the laboratory was this exhilarating, challenging, wonderful place full of ideas, and the classroom was this, I hoped, interesting, mm-hmm. but nonetheless dreary recitation of facts, right? Yeah. And so what could we do about that? And I thought, and part of the problem was I began to think, you know, these students in my class, they listen to my lectures, they read this big, massive textbook full of facts, they must think that everything to know about neuroscience is known because, you know, it's all there. We teach it like it's established. And that's not true. We know almost nothing about neuroscience. It's mostly an open question. And they must also think that the purpose of science is to uncover facts and put them in textbooks to torture undergraduates, basically, or some process like that. Neither of those things is the case. And so I thought, well, what I really want to teach students is a course on what we don't know. I want them to get a glance at what we don't know. So I somewhat provocatively called this class Ignorance. And I started this class called Ignorance. And I use the title to be provocative because I don't mean stupidity or a callous indifference to facts. I mean the real deep unknown. I mean what we don't know. And the class was open to all students. You didn't have to be a science major. And in fact, more recently, I would say half the class are not science majors, which gives me a lot of gratification, I must say. And the class was a seminar class, met for 2 hours once a week in the evening. I didn't run it over the pandemic because it didn't work in the pandemic, and I'm trying to reinstitute it now. Mm-hmm. It used to be in the spring. Will again be in the spring. I hope this spring, maybe next. But anyway, in the spring, it meets 2 hours a night, 2 hours once a week in the evening from 6 to 8. And the class basically is, there's some discussion and talk, but basically I invite members of the science faculty each week, a different person each week, from Columbia or from anywhere in New York or traveling through New York, somebody I know, to come and talk for 2 hours to the students about what they don't know. Not what they do know, not what or they've learned, what they don't know. And, you know, they always ask me, people say, well, my joke is that I call some professor up on the phone and I say, listen, Professor so-and-so, I'm teaching a class on ignorance and I think you'd be great. How would you like to do it? And, you know, after they laugh, usually, they say, yes, I'd love to do that. Because, of course, that's all we really like to talk about. And when they ask me, what should I do to prepare? I say, no, you don't prepare anything. No PowerPoint, no lecture. What I want you to do is come into this classroom the way you walk into your laboratory every morning. And then we'll just talk about why you chose this question, why this is an important question, why not that question, what will happen if you answer it, what new questions might arise, what are the newer questions, what question did you answer, and then what happened? What if you never get to answer this question? What will happen then? You know? So all of those sorts of things. And I've found that when scientists talk about what they don't know, they don't use jargon, they don't talk in a language nobody else can understand or follow. You can, it's a conversation. It's an interesting conversation for everybody, whether you have a scientific background or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes science suddenly accessible, and it gives people a sense of the adventure that it is in practice.
Yeah, that sounds truly exciting. I'll be looking out for the comments.
I'm trying to get a backup on the board. It's not trivial to recover from this pandemic in certain administrative areas, because you have to do everything a couple years in advance to get a classroom space and all that. So, and then scheduling people to come in and all that. So it's tricky business. But I'm hoping to get it up in either this spring or next.
Yeah, that sounds truly amazing. And I guess speaking of your vision for the future, or if you were to talk about something that you don't know, then what would be like some of the questions you ask in terms of
research? Well, I'm often asked that. So what's your big question? And my feeling is, of course, you don't have a big question. You have lots of little questions. There are questions everywhere. Mm-hmm. The issue is, how do you choose among these questions? Because you're not going to get to all of them. For me, the question that my laboratory is particularly involved in right now is understanding how, as I've said a couple times, I think, but understanding how the brain parses complicated blends of chemicals into a single perception. How does that arise? How does that happen? And I think that I'm interested in that not only because I think olfaction is cool and an interesting thing, right? But also because I believe that if we figure out how that works in olfaction, it will help us to understand many other things that go on in the brain, the way the brain handles other kinds of information back and forth between different areas of the brain, how it encodes information like that, and so forth. So when I say we study olfaction, we do, because I love olfaction. I think it's interesting, and I think it's important for understanding behavior. It's also important for human beings and things like food and nutrition and palatability. Many other things that we use olfaction for, we don't even realize we do. I'll give you the quick point on this. So one of the biggest problems with our sense of smell, actually, is that we walk on two legs, because our noses are about 5 feet in the air and all the good smells are down on the ground, you know. People always ask me, they say, I'm sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent, but people always say, well, geez, don't dogs have a much better sense of smell than people? Don't they have a really good sense of smell? And my answer to that always is, well, if you had such a good sense of smell, would you do that thing they do when they meet each other, where they stick their nose? I mean, that seems like not a good sense of smell at all. Seems like you could do that from 3 feet away if you had a good sense of smell. The difference is that dogs put their nose where the odors are, and we don't. We meet each other, we shake hands, we don't smell each other's armpits or things like that, right? Which is good. I'm all for that. It's okay. But we miss a lot of information. Where we do use our sense of smell is in our sense of flavor, not taste, but flavor. So taste is really sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and savory, or umami as it's sometimes called. Everything else is olfactory. And that's part of putting food in your mouth, chewing it, and when you chew your food, the chemicals go up onto your olfactory epithelium by a pathway in the back of your mouth, and then you smell the food. This is all unconscious, mind you, and that's what gives food its flavor. That's why when you have a cold, food doesn't taste like much, because all you taste is sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. You don't get the flavor when you have a cold, because you use your olfactory sense for that. And arguably, we have one of the most discriminating palates on the planet. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think olfaction is a good model system for many other questions in the brain. So you can study it on its own, but you can also use it as a very accessible system for asking bigger questions in the brain.
And you mentioned dogs and like humans, so when you're studying, like, do you find it like have to like differentiate between animals versus a human, or how do you go about
it? Well, at least as far as mammals are concerned, and at least as far as vertebrates actually are concerned, we all share a very highly conserved system. So assuming you believe in evolution, and that your listeners do as well, that's one of the great advantages of evolution, is that we know these systems have a homologous counterpart, if you will, in other animals. So they're not that different from us in many ways, right? I mean, a dog's brain is smaller, or a mouse brain. We work on mice, and the mouse brain is smaller, but it does many of the same things our brains do. Mice don't read, you know, they don't go to the movies, I guess, or certain other things that we do. There's certain higher cognitive processes that seem to be human-specific, although, you know, many other animals, dolphins and chimpanzees and primates of various sorts have been shown to do far more complex things than we thought, and even birds. I mean, we now find tool use in birds, and birds not only use tools, but they make tools. So, yes, crows and ravens and corvids, those sorts of birds. They recognize themselves in a mirror. Dolphins do that. Higher primates do that. So we now recognize that many of our mammalian relatives especially have very high levels of brain function. And we can learn a lot about the brain by looking at how they work, how they do things as well.
Yeah, that's really a truly exciting field.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I guess just as one of the final questions, do you have, you do have like a rather like non-traditional career path and also just like really successful here nowadays, like for our young like students and listeners out there, do you have any like advice or suggestions?
Yeah, don't do what I did. Yeah. That's always the advice you give, don't do what I did. But that's not really true. I don't want to give advice in the sense of a prescription because I think people need to follow, you know, the kind of things that interest them. But I do think I think a couple of things about this, I guess. Number one, you have more freedom of choice than you think you do. The university and the institutions surrounding science would like to pigeonhole you and make you do this that way and tell you that this is the way to do it and these are the steps. And that's almost never true. If you talk to almost any scientist in any laboratory, you will find an individual story that's different than what you thought was the prescribed path. And so you also need to follow, anybody needs to follow what interests them. There's probably nothing worse to do than science that doesn't interest you. That's just useless. That's really drudgery. Because it's too hard. I mean, science is hard work. So it damn well better interest you to put in that kind of work. So at least for science. And the other thing I would say is, we haven't really touched much on this otherwise, but I would say don't be afraid of failure. That failure is a crucial part of the process. And that we can fail far more often than we think. Not 100%. I'm not suggesting you can just blow off every exam and fail every course and do fine. That's not true. But I think we can fail more often than we think, and we can recover from it quite easily and move on from it. Not just learn from it, but move on from it. Endorse it. I mean, you actually have to embrace failure in science to some extent. It's not that you've learned how to avoid that mistake. It's that you've actually learned something useful from that failure. And it's important to just realize it happens. I'll very quickly give you a quick example of this from biology, if I can.
Yeah.
The evolutionary, the prime predators in evolution, or the top of the evolutionary ladder, as it were, or the outer branches, you know, killer whales, hawks, lions and tigers, that sort of thing. You know, the primary predators, the top of the food chain. If you look at the predator-prey literature, you might think that these guys, anytime they get a little hungry, they just go out and bag a snack of some sort, some poor little prey animal that they just gobble up. But in point of fact, if you look at the predator-prey literature, these number top predators are successful fewer than 75% of the time. So 25% of the time that, I'm sorry, fewer than, I said that backwards. They fail 75% of the time. They're successful less than 25% of the time. So they maintain a high failure rate. 75% of their attempts at getting an animal fail, and yet they're the number one predators. They're the top of the evolutionary, you know, competition. So you can fail more than you think.
Yeah. Well, that is a great note.
I guess that's the way we end this. Huh?
Yeah, well.
This was probably a total failure.
That was awesome. But yeah, well, thank you so much for like joining us, Professor Feinstein, and for sharing your insights and experience with
us. Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Sophie. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. That concludes another episode of Columbia University BioBytes. To hear more about interviews with prominent scientists working at the intersection of biology, engineering, medicine, computer science, and mathematics, be sure to subscribe to our podcast channel on Spotify, known as Columbia BioBytes. Thank you for joining us.